Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is a special election edition of Your Call. Every Wednesday through the day after the midterm elections on November 6th from 11 to noon, we will air a special Your Call focusing on California's critical races and propositions. Today, we are hosting a debate on Proposition 10, which would repeal the 1995 Costa-Hawkins Rent Control Housing Act. Costa-Hawkins prevents cities from extending rent control on condos, single-family homes, and other units built after 1995 or earlier in cities that had already implemented rent control. The law also permits landlords to raise rents by any amount on rent-controlled units if a tenant leaves or is forced out. About 43% of California's population, or 17 million people, are renters, and California is home to some of the highest rents in the country. If Proposition 10 passes, it will allow governments to once again implement rent control laws, but this has to happen at the local government level. Joining us to discuss Prop 10 are three guests. Shanti Singh is Communications and Development Coordinator at Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. Tenants Together was one of several organizations that gathered more than 500,000 signatures to place Proposition 10 on California's ballot in November. Groups supporting the repeal include the AIDS Healthcare Foundation and the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment Action Plan. And Shanti Singh joins us in studio. Hi, Shanti. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We are also joined by Deborah Carlton, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs of the California Apartment Association, the country's largest statewide group representing owners, investors, developers, managers, and suppliers of rental homes and apartments. And the California Apartment Association is no on 10. Hi, Deborah. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by Noah Arroyo, assistant editor at San Francisco Public Press. He has written extensively about housing and homelessness in California. Hi, Noah. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Great to have you. Well, Noah, we wanted to bring you on because you have written extensively about what people out there are facing. And I mentioned that there are about 17 million renters in California. Just a couple numbers. The median rent for a one-bedroom in Los Angeles is $2,000. A one-bedroom in San Francisco is $3,500. Palo Alto, $3,500. Give us a sense of what we're facing right now.
Well, those are some great stats, and you can take your pick of plenty others. I was looking through some reports to try to find something that was indicative of the crisis that we're in. If our listeners don't know about it, it's a housing crisis, it's a cost of living crisis, and it has ripple effects throughout everybody's daily lives. But what I found was that in 2015, this is 2015 data from the California Budget and Policy Center, they were reporting that a quarter of California renters pay more than 30% of their incomes on housing, which is the definition of being overburdened by housing costs. Now, an additional quarter of renters throughout the state pay more than half of their incomes, more than 50%. So, as you might imagine, and sadly, this affects black and brown people much more than it does white. They make up a greater slice of the people who are overburdened by rent and housing costs throughout the state. So rent control is something that can possibly push back on this. It's a policy at the local level. It has a bunch of different aspects to it, but one of the major hallmarks is going to be an annual limit on rent increases on those units. Right. So these rent increase limits are going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There are 15 throughout the state that we know about. It should be said that 15 is the widely reported number, but there is no clearinghouse officially for rent control information.
Right.
So it could be that there are local jurisdictions that have some version of this that we haven't heard about. But generally, the annual limit on rent increases is what you look for. In San Francisco, that's I always get it mixed up with Berkeley. I think it's 60% of the consumer price index regionally, which is a marker for local inflation. And in some place like Berkeley, for instance, has 65% of the CPI increase annually. So this is supposed to keep rents from going out of control. There are a bunch of different aspects of rent control policies, which I'm sure we'll get into. But what's on the ballot at the state level right now is Proposition 10, which, as you said, would repeal these state-level restrictions on what local jurisdictions can do. And I know that's complicated, and I'm sure we're going to get into the minutia of that.
Yes, we will definitely talk about that. And we'll talk about what, for example, if Prop 10 passes, could happen in San Francisco or a
right.
place like Santa Rosa where there is no rent control.
Right.
Shanti, you work with Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. And your group is one of a number of groups that gathered more than 500,000 signatures to place Prop 10 on the ballot in November. This was tried in the state capitol, and it didn't happen, didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Why did you all decide to take this to the voters?
Well, rent control is a broadly popular policy with broad majority support. I think UC Berkeley came out with a poll last year saying over 60% of polled folks in California support rent control. You know, Costa-Hawkins repeal is one of the primary goals of the renters' rights movement, and we're going to keep using or working on every front until we can repeal Costa-Hawkins. So, you know, we pushed very hard for that to happen with Assembly Bill 1506. It did not pass committee, so now we're taking it directly to the voters because we know that this is what California's renters want.
And again, if this passes, we will see change at the local level, right? So how would that play out? Because let's say, for example, in a city, you have more supervisors who do not want rent control than supervisors who do want rent control.
Well, then your supervisors aren't going to pass rent control. That's one of the biggest misconceptions about Costa-Hawkins. All repealing Costa-Hawkins does is allows municipalities in California to choose what level of rent control under what conditions is right for them. So, and most of the overwhelming majority of the time, even before Costa-Hawkins passed, new construction, for example, was exempted. You know, the rates change. Like Noah mentioned, like there's, you know, different structures for CPI. There's different conditions under which all these rent control laws exist, and they're tailored to the needs of that city. So, you know, if the supervisors in a city decide that they don't want rent control, even if Costa-Hawkins is repealed, you know, it could go to the ballot, but it's still allowing for the democratic process to occur in a way that's tailored to the needs of every California municipality.
And we'll get into more of the details throughout today's show. According to Curbed Los Angeles, the pro side, the Yes on 10 side, has so far raised about $10 million, and most of that is coming from the Los Angeles-based AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Mm-hmm. Is that right? $10 million?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Okay.
I've seen a slightly higher number, but that sounds about right. I saw 12.6 recently, but just in the last few days.
Okay. And Deborah Carlton is Senior VP of Public Affairs of the California Apartment Association. This is the country's largest statewide group representing developers, investors, owners. And Deborah, according to this piece, the real estate investors and other opponents of Prop 10 have raised more than $21 million. Is that right?
I think you're right on that.
Okay.
We know that we're going to have to match what the support side does, and because it's coming from one particular individual, that's going to be a challenge. But we have a lot of small property owners who know they're going to be affected by this. So we're seeing their interest peaked and their participation financially.
And talk about the main reason why your group opposes Prop 10.
Well, there's a lot of reasons, but, you know, I think you will find all of the literature from any kind of university or economist will tell you that rent control creates disincentives for property owners to stay in the business. We saw that in the 1970s and 80s with extreme forms of rent control. Rental property owners converted their property to another use, so we lose housing under rent control. We also see that it just doesn't incentivize individuals to produce housing. So now that we have an incredibly big challenge with the production of rental housing, this is just going to be more of a disincentive and harm our housing crisis and make it worse. And so it doesn't also, I think the third thing, it's very inefficient in who gets the rent-controlled unit. So while it may keep individuals in place, as we've heard, the main protection that Prop 10 supporters will espouse, it also keeps the rich in place. So it doesn't say that, rent control is just for people with low incomes because there's no means testing. So we end up with a very inefficient allocation of housing.
Well, let's go over all of those and have a conversation about these different points. So let's talk about this point that Deborah is making. The question is, who gets the units? There's no means testing when it comes to rent control. Shanti, how would you reply to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we hear all the time. It's not the first time we've heard this. We hear that with a lot of local rent control campaigns, too. But the fact of the matter is, if people can afford to own a home, they buy a home. Right. If people can afford to live in a more expensive unit or buy a condo or something like that, they don't stay in their rent controlled units. And, you know, as Noah said, there's a disproportionate number of renters who are low income, who are people of color, who are seniors on a fixed income. The sort of means testing argument just really doesn't fit the facts. It's common sense. If someone is rich enough, if there is some hypothetical multimillionaire renter, I'm pretty sure they just pony up and buy a condo.
Deborah?
Well, you know, that's a simple answer for, I think, a much more complicated issue. Remember, landlords still have the ability to make a decision who rents that unit from them. And so they're going to pick the individual probably with the highest income. And we also see individuals taking units that are their second rental home. They may live in another place, but they'll take a rental unit in the city because it's convenient. They may work there or what have you. So, you know, I think that's the most unfortunate part about this is it does disincentivize landlords from renting to people with lower incomes, and we see that all the time. We saw the studies in the 70s and 80s where we lost low-income individuals in the strict forms of rent control. Like Berkeley, they lost a very large of their low-income population because renters were being moved out of the city. And that was most unfortunate, and I think the reason why we ended up with Costa-Hawkins.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, that's what we're seeing now. Los Angeles is losing 5.5 rent-controlled units every day. Every day, according to the Coalition on Economic Survival. What we see at Tenants Together, we have a statewide counseling hotline. We counsel thousands of tenants a year. We have 50 member organizations who counsel additional tens of thousands of tenants, if not more. We're seeing this happen now. We're seeing that Costa-Hawkins has put a target on the back of every renter. We are seeing that, you know, right now, landlords are, they will always be incentivized to, you know, see if there is a richer person that they can rent to. They will do what they can to get that tenant or poorer tenant out, whether they're in a rent-controlled unit or not. We're seeing that happen on a massive, unprecedented scale. And with state laws like the Costa-Hawkins and the Ellis Act, that helps preserve a status quo that works for landlords, because that's what Costa-Hawkins, people who are in favor of Costa-Hawkins, they want to preserve the status quo where we are hemorrhaging rent-controlled units.
Noah?
I just want to throw some stats in here to complicate this a bit. To the notion that rent-controlled tenants, that there are a lot of wealthy rent-controlled tenants. I mean, that's certainly possible. I think it makes sense that if I don't have to move out of my rent-controlled unit and I get a huge raise, then I may stay there just to bank the difference and maybe even buy property elsewhere. I've heard of that happening too. It's all anecdote from what I've encountered, but I haven't seen data. What I have seen is, at least in San Francisco, this is in the story that I wrote, Remaking Rent Control, that the income bracket of between 80% and 120% of the median area income, that's a range of between $57,000 and about $85,000 a year gross. So that income range has grown in rent-controlled units since, I want to say it was 1995, but I could be wrong. So that's gone from being 1% of the tenant and rent control stock in San Francisco to being about 28%. Now, meanwhile, low-income tenants have receded, that the lower-income brackets have reduced, but the upper incomes, anything beyond 120%, this has been fluctuations over time, nothing that I would call trend-level stuff. So at least in San Francisco, I'm sure you have some very wealthy people living in rent-controlled units, enough to, you know, call a trend. That's not what I see. And whether you see this statewide is a very different question.
Hmm. Noah Arroyo is assistant editor at The Public Press. He writes about housing, homelessness, politics. His latest piece is called Remaking Rent Control If Voters Approve. We're also joined by Deborah Carlton, senior vice president of public affairs of the California Apartment Association, the country's largest statewide group representing owners, investors, developers, and managers of rental homes and apartments. They are no on Prop 10, and they have raised more than $21 million so far. We're also joined by Shanti Singh, Communications and Development Coordinator at Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. They're Yes on 10. They and a number of organizations gathered more than 500,000 signatures to put Prop 10 on California's ballot, and they have raised $10 million so far. Their biggest backer is the Los Angeles-based AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And if you would like to join us, where do you stand on Prop 10? What questions do you have? What are your thoughts about rent control? Is there rent control where you live? If you're a tenant or a landlord, what are your thoughts on this? 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Shanti, what about Deborah's other argument? She says that repealing Costa Hawkins will not produce new housing.
Yeah, that's already pretty easily refutable in that, you know, the cities that have rent control right now are already some of the cities that are leaders in housing production. San Francisco has rent control. It's producing a decent amount of housing. We can produce more, but rent control isn't going to get in its way. Same with Santa Monica, same with Los Angeles, plenty of cities. And to get outside of California for a second, I think the most classic example of this was the argument made to repeal rent control in Massachusetts, particularly in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So the people coming in said rent control is stopping housing construction. If you repeal rent control, you're going to see a flourishing of new housing construction. You're going to see rents go down. They abolished rent control in Cambridge, and the exact opposite happened. You know, it's provably false that it halts new construction. And also, to be honest, this is a classic tactic. As a housing activist, I have seen this exact point repeated by the real estate industry anytime there is a threat to their profits of any sort, no matter how big or small, whether it was rent control, whether it was inclusionary zoning, which requires developers to set aside some units as below market rate or affordable or subsidized, whether it's just cause protections for eviction. Just cause just simply means you can be evicted, but your landlord has to specify the reason why they're evicting you. That there was an attempt to pass that law statewide in California this year. It did not pass, but that was one of the reasons. It said, you know, all of these things apparently are freezing housing construction somehow. And once you hear it so many times, I don't know how applicable it is.
Deborah?
Well, the reason why you see continued construction in cities with rent control today is because you have Costa Hawkins that prohibits rent control on new construction. However, if you pass a more stringent form of rent control, which would place rent control on new construction or even threaten it, you're not going to see developers place or build in those cities. What developer would? And as for inclusionary zoning, that is probably one positive answer to the housing crisis. We cleared the way in California through the legislature to allow local governments to pass local laws that would allow some of the new units to have caps, and that's a way of also ensuring that a portion of that new construction is available for low income. That's a more positive answer than allowing local governments to place a blanket rent control on all new construction, because we know that developers will not go. They're already saying they will not build in those cities that threaten rent control.
Yeah, I should note for the audience that repealing Costa Hawkins is not blanket rent control by any means. Repealing Costa Hawkins, again, does not create rent control on new construction. Major California cities that had rent control, including San Francisco, did not ever put restrictions on new construction before Costa Hawkins passed, right? Costa Hawkins was very much a draconian solution to a non-existent problem. And again, going back to this, concerns about the impact on construction can be raised locally. Nearly every city with rent control chose to exempt new construction, Costa Hawkins or no Costa Hawkins. Okay. Repealing Costa Hawkins simply allows that discussion to happen locally. It does not dictate the result.
Noah, what does the data tell us about this issue?
On some of this stuff, there isn't data. I want to backtrack, and some there is. I want to backtrack to some of the statements that were made. I think there's a strong argument to be made that Costa-Hawkins and rent control have very little to do with the rate of construction, of housing construction in these major cities that we're talking about. I mean, it's what they're desirable places to live. San Francisco, Santa Monica, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, you know, Berkeley. These are places where people want to live. And I think there's a pretty good argument to say that because people want to live there, you've got real estate developers historically who want to build high-end housing there mm-hmm. to capture the demand. Now, that's not all that was necessarily being built, you know, for decades. But if that ended up causing, we'll say, exacerbating, that's probably the fair way to put it, you know, some sort of a local housing crisis characterized by really low vacancy rates, increasing rents overall, then it's once again arguable that a local jurisdiction would enact something like rent control in order to capture some affordable units for, you know, the local low-income population. In other words, I think it's a little bit more complicated than saying that this is caused by what's going on with rent control policy, either at the local or at the state level. As far as the notion that a repeal of Costa-Hawkins would, you know, would make the housing crisis worse at a local level, I think the answer is possibly. It's possibly, because it depends on, as Shanti's saying, what type of local rent control policy were enacted, if any at all. Mm. And if it is not going to affect future construction, then I think the only argument that you can make is that just having a change at all creates uncertainty in the real estate market, which makes lenders nervous, banks nervous. And yes, that will absolutely have a negative impact.
And just to be clear again, if Proposition 10 passes, it will allow local governments to implement rent control laws and then put in any restrictions they want. Right. But this has to happen at the local level. So if Prop 10 passes, it's not like something's going to change overnight statewide. The local governments then have to take action. Right.
It is slightly more complicated, which is what is so interesting about this. Yes, technically, that is the simplest way to put it. What I discovered in my reporting was that in the year 2000, San Francisco's rent board, I'm sorry, I think it was the Board of Supervisors, passed a law that made its local rent control policy conform with the state's law, Costa-Hawkins. In other words, what Costa-Hawkins did was it outlawed, among other things, it outlawed rent control in single-family homes. And San Francisco's rent control policy did not specify single-family homes. But in 2000, they changed it to conform, which meant that if Costa-Hawkins were ever repealed thereafter, that single-family homes would still be exempt from rent control in San Francisco. Berkeley does not have such an exemption. So that means that technically, if you kill Costa-Hawkins in Berkeley, instantly single-family homes get rent controlled. Not the case in San Francisco.
Okay.
Now, how are those variations from one local jurisdiction to the next? I haven't looked at all of them.
Hmm. What would happen, for example, in a place like San Francisco, where, you know, if a building or a condo was built past 95, there's no rent control, right?
Right.
So just yesterday, SF Weekly's Nuala Sawyer reported that the resolution to support Costa-Hawkins needed 8 votes to pass, but got 7 on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Mm. So what does that mean if Prop 10 passes?
Well, we've got 5 seats.
Well, right,
up
there's
for
an election
grabs.
In November. But let's say
that's
you have a board that does not support the repeal of Costa-Hawkins. Then could the citizens put a measure on the ballot to take action?
Ooh, I'm not sure about the legalities of that. I suspect so. The reason I'm not sure is just because there are some local jurisdictions where rent control policy was enacted through the ballot, through the local ballot box, whereas in others, like in San Francisco, it was through the local legislature. I'm assuming that the ballot box could override the local legislature here.
Shanti?
Both are possible. So Tenants Together helps jurisdictions across California campaign for rent control laws or to organize tenants around those things. So, you know, we help campaigns that are trying to go to the ballot. For example, Sacramento is going to the ballot in 2020. Santa Cruz is going to the ballot for local rent control, regardless of what happens to Costa-Hawkins this year in November. It's on the same ballot. So that's certainly a possibility. I think it's also worth noting that in all of these jurisdictions, conversations and our experience over the last 10 years, and tenants together formed to fight back an effort from the real estate industry to repeal all rent control in California, to abolish it, called Prop 98. That's where we got started, so we've been doing this for a while. But it's worth noting that those are fights. The real estate industry is as powerful locally as it is statewide. They're obviously very powerful in terms of their contributions to politicians. So we expect Costa-Hawkins repeal or no Costa-Hawkins repeal. We expect to keep fighting. But yes, those dynamics are correct. You know, can go through city council, it can go through local ballot initiative. Oftentimes, local people power, people pressure, will actually push the city council to take action where they may not have otherwise.
So what about that issue, Deborah? Since this is going to happen at the local government level, if Prop 10 passes, why not let the community get together, the landlords, the tenants, and hash this out?
You know, that's a good question, but quite frankly, when you look at how poorly our local governments have done with the production of housing, I think that the pressure they're going to be under to impose rent control is going to be huge. And certainly if they disagree or will not pass a local rent control measure like we saw the debate in San Francisco yesterday, the voters will more than likely take it locally, and we'll have the voters potentially overturning anything that the supervisors or the city council has done. And, you know, I think the also what goes hand in hand with this are individuals who don't want housing in their local community. So often they will side with tenants, I think, to the tenant's detriment, to impose a strict form of rent control, because it will stop developers from coming there, and they won't see housing in their local jurisdiction. And I think that's really going to harm our problem and our housing supply here in California. If we pass strict forms of rent control, we won't see housing construction.
Yeah, I have to take some issue with that, especially related to Deborah's point about, you know, exclusionary homeowners, specifically because, you know, I was looking over the no on Prop 10 talking points, and one of the specific points was targeted at exclusionary homeowners. They were saying, oh, you will lose your property values if Prop 10 passes. I don't believe that that's true, but that's a demographic that's kind of being chased by the opposition, by our opposition in this case. So I'm not entirely, and that's a similar argument that you see when folks are talking about, well, I don't want new housing near me, it's going to reduce my property values. Well, then why are you saying that Costa-Hawkins repeal is going to reduce their property values if they would be for it, right? But yeah.
Shanti Singh is Communications and Development Coordinator at Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. Tenants Together was one of a number of organizations that gathered more than 500,000 signatures to place Prop 10 on California's ballot in November. So far, those groups have raised $10 million, most of it coming from the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. Deborah Carlton is Senior Vice President of Public Affairs of the California Apartment Association, the country's largest statewide group representing owners, investors, managers, developers, and suppliers of rental homes and apartments. The No side has so far raised $21 million. And Noah Arroyo is Assistant Editor at the San Francisco Public Press. Be sure to check out his piece, Remaking Rent Control, If Voters Approve. We've got a number of callers on the line. Let's start with NATO in San Francisco. Hi, NATO. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is NATO Green. I'm with four small property owners for Reasonable Controls. We're a pack of small landlords, and we support Prop 10 and support expanding rent control to all property in the state. This other person, we speak for all mom-and-pop landlords in the state. This other person definitely does not. And it is so, people need to understand how easy it is to be a landlord. Like, most of the time you don't do anything, and once a month someone sends you a check for a lot of money. It's people, politicians fall over to themselves to accommodate landlords and make our lives easier. We don't deserve more rights. Meanwhile, we know that, like, soaring rents destabilize communities and displace people from their homes and cause poverty. And if you can't figure out how to exercise your property rights and make a reasonable rate of return as a landlord without destroying other people's lives and communities, then you are in the wrong line of work.
NATO, how many members do you have in your group?
6.
Well, stay on the line. Maybe we can get you to go back and forth with Deborah. And NATO, Deborah, what are your thoughts about NATO's argument about what it's like to be a landlord?
He certainly represents a minority opinion. I think, you know, if you lived under the stringent form of rent control in Berkeley in the 1960s where your rents were rolled back, you couldn't do anything to your housing without begging the local rent board commission for any reimbursement of your costs. You had owners just got out of the business. You know, we're talking about the grander picture here, not 6 rental property owners who, I mean, I believe everything he says, and I believe he wants to do the right thing, as all rental property owners should. But having a local government control your every step is just not efficient, and it's not going to be helpful for our housing crisis.
Shanti.
Yeah. Well, thank you, NATO. I also, there are some bigger groups of small property owners who support Proposition 10, like the Property Owners for Fair and Affordable Housing. Look them up. They're quite large. But one thing that I want to get back to that kind of came up here, particularly with small landlords and mom-and-pop landlords, is that the industry is always talking about small and mom-and-pop landlords. But when you look at actually a couple of things, when you look at who's bankrolling the No on 10 campaigns, it's mega landlords, hundreds of properties, thousands of properties. And the reality is, when it comes to single-family homes especially, right, which you can't rent control any single-family homes under Costa-Hawkins, Wall Street is the biggest owner of single-family homes by far in the state of California. They are also a big force behind No on 10. Since the foreclosure crisis, which was already predatory mortgage lending targeted at working-class people that bankrupted them and kicked them out of their homes, what did Wall Street do? They came in, they bought up thousands of those homes, and then rented it back out to people. And what we are now seeing in those homes is black widow spider infestations, impromptu evictions, you know, mold problems, complete neglect, and $1,000 rent hikes. There's a tenant called Renita Barbie, if you want to look her up in the news. She received a nearly overnight $1,000 rent increase, and I believe her landlord was Blackstone Invitation Homes, which is the single largest owner of single-family home rentals in the state of California.
What happened to her?
Did
she move out, or is she finding the money?
She did not find the money. But, you know, why should Wall Street be categorically exempt from rent control across the state that contains a huge chunk of America's renters, a state of 17 million renters?
Well, and to that point, the LA Times just had a story about how Wall Street landlords are back. Investors bought more single-family rental homes in 2017 in California in previous years than the first increase since 2013. Firms like Blackstone Group, Tom Barrack's Colony Capital, rushed into the single-family rental business. Deborah, what percentage of your members are these big Wall Street firms?
So those are not our members, but I will tell you, they're not the largest owners of housing in California, of single-family homes. We have about 6 million rental homes in California. They own less than 1% of the homes, even far less than that, 0.25% in California of the rental population. So small. I mean, they're obviously an easy target and a scary target to dangle out there. But that's just not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the larger population of our ownership in California.
Noah, what does the data tell us about this? Do we have good data?
Well, to be honest, I haven't looked at what's happening statewide as much as I've looked at what's going on locally and regionally, specifically in San Francisco and Berkeley. But I'm curious, Deborah, if Costa-Hawkins were repealed, three things would be possible that aren't possible now. One is you could have rent control in single family homes. That's one. Two is you could have vacancy control, which we can explain for listeners if we get into that. Mm-hmm. And three is that you could have rent control on buildings constructed after 1995, or really just buildings constructed at any year beyond what the cutoff was locally, wherever that cutoff is. Out of those three things, which one scares you and your constituents the most?
Well, it's not really what should scare us, but what should really concern our local governments and tenants. So if you're talking about the single-family homes, I think tenants should be very concerned, because those are the easiest to eliminate on the market. And those folks, and we saw it in Berkeley, they lost about 3,000 single-family homes under the forms of rent control that they were imposing. So tenants are going to, unfortunately, and could very easily lose their housing, as you pointed out, in most of those jurisdictions that had single-family homes covered under rent control, the light switch will be flicked on if Proposition 10 passes. They will now automatically go under rent control. The second one, I think, that really does concern rental property owners is the vacancy control, meaning if Proposition 10 passes, local governments can tell rental property owners when there's a vacancy, no matter how far behind you were, if you had a tenant in there for 20 years, you cannot increase your rent, or we will control what the next rent level will be. For an owner who has had historically low rents, because as you know, rent control jurisdictions usually roll back the rent as soon as their rent control is passed, they're far behind. So having the inability to go with the market, and it's not whatever the landlord wants, it's what the rent, or at least what the local market will bear, you know, that is something that certainly is not favorable to the rental housing industry if you can't catch up at vacancy.
I should say that Berkeley is not going to be rolling back rents. My understanding is that their local ballot measure that's going to impose a form of what I've heard described as rolling rent control in the subject of my piece, but does not really officially have a name because it hasn't existed before.
Right.
But that will not roll back rents to some previous state. It's going to make the starting state what it is today. Yeah.
Well, they said they wanted the starting date so that it would go back in time, and then you would calculate what the rents, they believe what the rents should be from a date that is behind us, so 1980, for example. They would impose rent control on single-family homes and condominiums, and vacancy control would apply there. They did have also rent control on new construction in Berkeley when it was first passed. So, you know, the light switch there would be turned on as well.
Shanti?
Yeah, so it's also one thing to note is that under every rent control law that exists in California, there is a rent board composed of landlords and tenants. For example, in San Francisco, we actually have some pretty big landlords on our rent board who adjudicate these things. But every landlord in California under rent control can petition and does have successfully petitioned for a fair rate of return. If you go to the rent board, you will have a fair hearing. There will be landlords hearing your case in addition to tenants. And they will say, well, if you really are burdened in some way by this rent control, we will allow an increase above the rent control cap. You can always do that. It works. It's been working.
But tenants can get exemptions from those increases in the same way.
Yeah. So it would be up to the rent board to evaluate. But the idea that you're sort of locked in, if you as a landlord can provide a reasonable case, and we've seen that happen a lot, if a landlord can provide a reasonable case, they, you know, the rent board will give them a fair hearing and they can get an increase above that. So it's not as if there's no process, as if landlords are trapped somehow. And the other thing, too, that I wanted to emphasize is that this is happening now. Tenants are being kicked out now. Disproportionately poor tenants, disproportionately working class tenants, tenants of color, they are targeted for eviction and displacement, whether they live in a rent-controlled unit or not. And right now, we just released a study at Tenants Together based off of data from the California Judicial Council that there's 17 million tenants, right? One in every 34 tenants, that's 500,000 tenants every year, face a court eviction. So if you know 34 tenants, one of them is most likely going to face a court eviction. That does not include being chased out by a rent hike. That isn't tracked. So for example, you know, if your landlord says you have to pay $1,000 next month extra, or you're gone and you leave, that's not tracked. Any sort of 30 or 60 day notices aren't tracked. So the idea that, you know, Costa-Hawkins repeal is going to incentivize landlords to kick out tenants, they're already doing that now and they're making a lot of money doing it.
Well, we have
Proposition 10 doesn't fix that. That's the unfortunate part. It wasn't a thoughtful measure. It doesn't fix any of that. And if we had, I think, a more thoughtful measure instead of just a blanket, do whatever you want, city, we might have had, I think, some place for everybody to find a reasonable compromise, but that's not what Prop 10 does.
What would a compromise look like?
You know, it really depends upon what the tenant organizations would even agree to. We had a report out of Berkeley, the Turner study, that gave some a foundation from which to find a compromise. But the tenants, before the ink was even dried on that, completely rejected it. And so I think that's most unfortunate, because we don't have, I think, a better discussion or compromise other than the complete elimination of what was seen as a more rational form of rent control.
Just real quick, we've got a lot of callers on the line. I just want to make sure we get to them. Today, it is a special election edition of Your Call. We're going to have a conversation every Wednesday through the day after the midterm election on November 6th to talk about critical races and propositions. Today, we're talking about Proposition 10, which would repeal the 1995 Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act. If Prop 10 passes, it will allow local governments to implement rent control laws. And that is Deborah Carlton, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs of the California Apartment Association. They are no on 10. So far, they've raised $21 million. Shanti Singh is Communications and Development Coordinator at Tenants Together. Yes on 10. They have raised $10 million. And Noah Arroyo is Assistant Editor at the San Francisco Public Press, and he writes extensively about on housing. Let's go through a few calls, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Gloria in San Francisco. Hi, Gloria. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I live in the Mission. I'm a renter, and I have rent control, but I've seen too many of my friends in the Mission be evicted, have their rents go sky high, not only because of Costa-Hawkins, but because of the Ellis Act. There are two laws that were created in Sacramento by the landlords, and, you know, in the work that I'm doing with many other people for Prop 10, most people don't even know about Costa-Hawkins, and it's like every commodity, every need of the people, whether it's housing, healthcare, higher education, they've all become commodities for super profits in those three elements that are most essential. And I think people are really fed up. Deborah Carlton said that there are renters who have, you know, two apartment units. That is, I really believe, bogus. I have a friend lived on Harrison Street, and his mother was quite ill in another state. She's elderly. He had to go and help her for a couple months. His landlord was looking out day by day and found that he wasn't there anymore temporarily, and she got evicted because it was claimed he had two units. That's the reality of people. Renters, I think the great majority, 99%, I would say, of renters don't have two units, don't have a way that they're getting over on the landlords. And I want to urge people who are for Prop 10 to contact Yes on Prop10.org and California for Prop10.org. We got to get out there and encourage our co-renters and also people who own houses. I want to say, here in the Mission, we've been going door to door to the businesses, and they want commercial rent control because they're all getting evicted too by this idea that you can gouge people as much as the quote market can bear.
Well, Gloria, thank you for calling. We're going to take another caller who has a related question, and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and thanks again for a timely program. So how does Ellis Act affect rent control? Right now, a good friend of mine has been under rent control for the last 35 years. The building he lives in, a four-unit building, changed ownership, and now he's being served with Ellis eviction. And apparently, in the research he's done, the good rent control laws that exist in San Francisco seem to be superseded by the state law, which is the Ellis Act. And how would this Prop 10 affect that?
Well, thank you. So the Ellis Act is a California law that allows landlords to evict tenants to, quote, go out of the rental business, right? Noah, how would Prop 10 affect the Ellis Act if it passes?
As far as I know, it wouldn't have a direct impact. You'd still have the Ellis Act, and you'd still have local rent control laws. The two would operate in parallel, and as before, you know, the Ellis Act would supersede, and scenarios like this could continue.
Yeah, the Ellis Act, Prop 10 would not have an influence on the Ellis Act. What the Ellis Act is really used for is to, for example, if you want to, it was intended to let landlords exit the market. However, what we're finding is that the Ellis Act is used to clear a building, especially if it has rent control to get tenants, by invoking the Ellis Act, you can clear the entire building at once. And we see this happen all the time. So the Ellis Act and Costa Hawkins work as this sort of awful version of a dynamic duo where, you know, it's a tag team to get these rent-controlled tenants out. As I mentioned, that Coalition on Economic Survival study in Los Angeles, where 5.5 rent-controlled units are lost every day, the Ellis Act is part of that. It pairs with the vacancy decontrol in Costa Hawkins. So it lets you clear the building, and then you can raise the rents back up to market rate. Another thing that study, or a different study, I believe, also in Los Angeles found for there was that the average tenure between the time someone, a landlord, purchases the building and then the time they invoke the Ellis Act is 7 years. So it's not like it's a long-term holding and I just want to get out of the market and retire, et cetera. It's interesting, too, because it kind of harkens back to back in 1978, Harvey Milk, before he was assassinated, wanted to institute a speculation tax for house flipping, and it would be scaled between 1 and 7 years. So it's kind of perfect in a terrible way to think about the fact that this is the average tenure. He saw this coming. He saw that the Ellis Act would be used for mostly short to medium term speculation. Mm-hmm. But
we should be clear on what the Ellis Act is really about. It was a way to allow owners to go out of the business. You're absolutely right on that. But local governments have the complete control of how that happens. So if a landlord is claiming to go out of the business and then jacking up the rent, that's illegal. They cannot do that, and local governments should be penalizing them for doing that. They cannot do that. Rental property owners who go out of the business do, however, have the ability to sell their housing to owner-occupants, for example, or if a city will allow it, they're allowed to convert to condos. A lot of cities will not allow that, however. But the local governments have the ability to stop that activity. And if they're not doing it, I say shame on local governments, because the Ellis Act was not intended for that. It's not a state law that trumps what's going on at the local level. You go out of the business, period. You can't just give eviction notices and raise the rents on next tenants, because there must not be new tenants. So that's a fallacy that's happening. And if it is happening, local governments have that complete authority to fix that.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of limitations on that. So in San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors, I believe it was initiated by Supervisor David Campos at the time, tried to add some things to the Ellis Act, or rather modify the buyouts, right? So basically saying that, like, there are a lot of these buyouts are very predatory. They buy people out of the building for, you know, way less than they could get. They just assume that they will take the money and leave. This attempt at actually trying to even raise the buyout amount passed with great difficulty at the Board of Supervisors and then was, I believe, overturned. So, legally overturned. So there actually are quite a lot of restrictions to local governments and to what they can try to do to get some relief for these tenants who are being kicked out anyway.
Well, Mo and Gloria, thank you for calling. And losing your apartment is such a traumatic experience. And mm-hmm. We've heard from so many people who have lost their apartments. And be sure, if you live in San Francisco, let people know about Proposition F, which recently passed, and it provides legal representation for tenants, because this can be an expensive process. It's a difficult process if you don't know the law. So be sure to let people know that they do have legal representation if they lose their home or if they get an eviction notice. And Deborah, I want to bring it back to the human experience and what's happening here. There's a woman in Santa Rosa, Thea Hartman, who is on a fixed income, $980 a month. She spent her career as a therapist, but she had cancer and most of her money went to her healthcare bills, which sadly is a very common story in this country. And so she's on again, $980 a month is what she gets from Social Security. Her rent is $506 a month. She's in a senior complex. She's been there for 7 years. Her rent has increased by 17% over the last 2 years. Now, of course, in San Francisco, people are going to say, $500 a month, that's so cheap. It's not cheap for people who have a monthly limited income. What do you say to people like Thea Hartman? I mean, this is a 72-year-old woman who goes to bed at night wondering if she's going to have an apartment in the morning.
Well, and I think that's the unfortunate part of what's going on in California, is we don't have enough housing for people to live. We don't have enough housing that's affordable. Proposition 1, for example, is going to provide answers. Proposition 1 is the measure that's going to provide low-income housing, $4 billion to build low-income housing. That's our answer. Proposition 10 is not going to fix any of those scenarios that you just relayed to me. That's not the answer. There is no incentives at all to provide a new housing for people to live. So, you know, I think that's the, you tell the stories, but Proposition 10 is not going to answer.
But what about keeping Thea in her home? Because people say that passing rent control will keep her in her home because her rent will not be able to be increased by 17% over 2 years.
I don't know how Proposition 10 does that, but turns it back over to the local governments. It's just not going to do that. There's so many things about housing, such as its age, whether or not it can be or would come under any kind of recreation of rent control at the local level. You know, you can't paint housing in California with one single broad brush. It's much more complicated because of its age, because of maybe what needs to happen to the housing, whether they need a new roof, whatever. But you have to provide affordable housing for individuals and for it to remain affordable forever. Again, Proposition 1 is that answer.
Shanti, just briefly.
Yeah, I'm really glad that Deborah mentioned painting it with a broad brush, because California, Costa-Hawkins paints California housing policy with a broad brush. It prevents that tenant from ever having the chance to not have a predatory rent hike on her. Let's be clear, the California Apartment Association is telling you it should be perfectly legal to double someone's rent overnight, and we don't feel that way. Our 50 member organizations don't feel that way. Yeah, I mean, honestly, blaming rent control for the existence of housing speculation, which is still half rampant in places without rent control, is like blaming a firefighter for the existence of the fire. We can build affordable housing and we can have rent control, and that Prop 1 is going towards subsidized affordable housing. In other words, it is meeting a need that the market refuses to provide even now. So it's good, but it's all about it's protect, preserve, and produce.
Deborah, your response?
Well, Proposition 1 is the answer to provide new housing, because the cost, unless government is involved, meaning providing some sort of tax credits, you just can't provide housing today in California because of the cost of land, the cost of construction, the cost of labor. You have to have more of a involvement when it comes to either tax incentives or tax credits. That's the way to provide affordable housing in California.
And Noah, final thoughts based on the reporting you've done.
Sure. In recent decades, we've seen in California that we are far behind how much housing we should be building. We're far behind other states in the nation. So the point's well taken. We've got a housing crisis because we are not building enough housing in a broad sense. There are a lot of caveats to that statement. That said, I don't want to speak for Shanti and other housing activists, but I think that what rent control is seen as is a response to that, somewhat of a stopgap. It's a way to help people survive a housing crisis that there is no quick way to remedy.
Noah Arroyo is assistant editor at San Francisco Public Press. Check out yourcallradio.org to find out his latest piece about rent control. Shanti Singh is communications and development coordinator at Tenants Together, California's statewide organization for renters' rights. They are yes on Prop 10, and so far they have raised $10 million. Deborah Carlton is Senior Vice President of Public Affairs of the California Apartment Association. They are no on Prop 10, and so far they have raised $21 million. Again, Proposition 10 would repeal the 1995 Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act. If Prop 10 passes, it will allow local governments to implement rent control laws. Shanti, Deborah, and Noah, thank you all for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. Every Wednesday, we're going to be doing a special California election show. If you have any show ideas, email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.